This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky, executive editor of the New England News Collaborative. In case you don't know what that means, it's okay. I'm still figuring it out myself. Today, we launch a new version of our weekly news roundtable, Lucy Nalpathanchil. We'll be back tomorrow with a fresh Where We Live. But today is our chance to look at the week's news here in Connecticut and nationally with an illustrious panel of reporters, columnists, political observers. But first, the news from the week out of context.
Go at life with a lot of oomph.
I'm not going to be speaker after this term.
We want to have baseball played as quickly as possible.
He went inside to check it out, and there was four men on the field playing baseball.
Here to tackle those stories and more are Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hi, Colin.
It just feels so new. It feels like it's totally different here.
It has a new show smell.
You know what else it is? Connecticut is so quiet without Jody Rowell, too. Since she went to Florida, it just feels quiet here.
It feels quiet and just a little sad and strange. Hi there, Colin. And also hi to Daniela Altamar, who's State House reporter for the Hartford Current. Good morning, Daniela.
Hi.
And Keith Vanniff is here. He's our state budget guru. He's the budget reporter for the Connecticut Mirror. Hello once again, Keith.
Good morning.
You can join the conversation at 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. Yeah, we've got a new handle, so you can check us out both places, WNPR Wheelhouse. Later on in the program, I'll let you know what I heard about American politics during a week in England and Scotland. Let's just say you shouldn't be surprised that they're scratching their heads at us a little bit. But first, we've been away for a few weeks, so we should probably get an update on the state budget. We've been hearing a lot, Colin, about looming cuts at whether it's schools in towns or schools at the university level. People are worried about what's in this budget. I've been away for a week or so. What do you know about what's in the budget?
Less than Keith and Daniela do. Just to sort of maybe even just set the stage time-wise, I believe the last time we assembled as a wheelhouse was on the Wednesday going into the final night of the session, which turned out not to be a particularly critical time since they didn't really do anything in the final night of the session. So since then, they have met in special session. They've passed a budget. They've passed implementers. There's been a lot of complaining, not unwarranted complaining from the Republicans in particular about not knowing until the last minute what's in what. The implementers this year seem, every year, so just to kind of, Keith and Daniela can do a much better job, but just to kind of set that stage and not to use too clubby a term, the implementers are the mechanical language which actually implement the budget. However, what they've always been for decades now is this dumping ground for all kinds of things, bills that have not had public hearings, last-minute arrangements with cronies, things that have been lobbied for but not publicly discussed. All these things kind of pile up in this huge refuse heap of the 291 page implementers. From what I can tell, and I haven't done the kind of thorough analysis that our other panelists have, the implementers, every year you sort of say, well, it couldn't get worse, it couldn't get crazier, you couldn't get an implementer that had less to do with implementing the budget, but they seem to break their own records every year, and I think they did it again this year, but I'll throw it over to Keith. I know one thing we're going to discuss also is a separate issue, a bill that actually sort of conceals some of the information that's available about the budget. But Keith, before we do that, maybe just sort of say where the budget lies right now and what you see in it.
This budget was definitely different. It sort of broke a recent trend. The whole discussion all this year was about avoiding tax increases, you know, one way or the other, and they did accomplish that. They did reduce what would have been a built-in hole of about $1 billion, largely by keeping spending flat at the current year's level. Depending on how you slice it, you can argue it's a little more or a little less. To me, the real story in this budget is it relies really heavily on what I'll call partially defined cuts. There are a lot of savings targets the governor has to find once the fiscal year is underway. Probably, for example, savings in labor costs that are worth twice the value of the layoffs that he's going forward with right now. So does that mean more layoffs are on the way? They're hoping labor will come to the table. Or if we don't get the savings we need there, does that mean he'll, you know, come July or September, he'll be cutting social services using his rescissionary authority? That's the real question mark. And as always in all these budgets, the areas that got the big increases were our contributions to the pension system, our debt payments. That's eating up all the growth in the budget. Most areas, including the governor's transportation initiative and municipal aid, certainly got pulled back from the levels that were promised.
So I have two quick questions for you, Keith. One is, are we still looking at a moving target, though? I mean, despite whatever promises are made in this budget about potential savings we might find. Maybe, you know, labor comes back to the table and we find some savings there, or maybe we don't and we have to find those savings someplace else. Are we still looking at a budget that, because of the revenue projections that have been so far off over the course of the last several months, are we still looking at a budget that may be again out of balance relatively soon?
We are, and I think there's even a bigger political question, because I think there's two moving parts. There's the revenue side you talked about. It seems like every time we test the revenues, our income tax is not as robust as we'd hoped. But then there's the spending side. And again, if the governor can't get the savings he's looking for, does he start doing emergency cuts in the election season? I'm really wondering, will he in September or October cut back while they're running, his fellow Democrats are on the campaign trail?
Yeah, and we already saw labor obviously not happy. In fact, they've announced that they're going to be discouraging their members from attending the big Democratic fundraising dinner. They're not happy with Malloy and the Democratic legislators. But nobody's happy. I mean, social services aren't happy. Human service providers aren't happy. Parents of kids with developmental disabilities aren't happy. Nobody's happy. So,
well, it's this current services budgeting that I want to dig into a little bit more, because if we hold spending flat, I think we all know that in almost any business, certainly in most of our households, the cost of stuff we have to do goes up year on end. And what we're essentially looking at is cuts that are coming in part because we're not keeping up with the rate of increase in cost. I mean, that's where the cuts are coming from, really, aren't they, Danielle?
Yeah, and this line drawn in the sand that says we weren't going to raise taxes this year. That was, without doing that, what do you do?
And Danielle, maybe you could say a little bit more about this. I mean, we're already starting to see the bleed from this. And so your newspaper today has splashed across the front page, this pretty disturbing story about what really basically the consequence of cuts to disability services. These incredibly vulnerable people under the care of the state who are being subjected to all kinds of apparent horrors. I mean, to me, this is more troubling than how unhappy labor is right now. I know these things are all kind of tied together. The labor sector are the people who would be providing some of these services. Some of the services are provided by outside contractors. But to me, that story was one of the many canaries in the coal mine.
And presumably, further cuts mean more stories like that and more tragedies, more sad situations.
So Keith, what comes out of all this? Obviously, there's been so much that has gone into this. As Colin said, the legislature and the governor didn't really agree to get everything done before the deadline. And this is still a work in progress in some ways, because we're finding out what's in this actual budget. But more cuts may be coming down the pike. I mean, what comes out of all of this now?
I think there's two questions. What comes out of it before Election Day and what comes out after? I mean, after, I think you're going to see a dramatic change, especially if the Democrats remain in the majority, and you will see a revenue debate. I think that's almost certain in 2017. To me, the real question is, I mean, don't forget, this administration, when the governor was running for re-election in 2014, not only reported zero problems, zero red ink in the budget – right up until Election Day. They actually reported zero deficiencies, which is a fancy term for, is there even a hint of a problem? They were basically saying, no, we're hitting budget perfection. Everything's fine. Will Governor Malloy maintain that outlook while the Democrats are running for re-election?
Well, look, since you're talking about reporting on the state budget, this is the other thing you've been reporting on this week, Keith, and it's sort of a fascinating little piece of legislation that came in that you're paying attention to, maybe more of us should be paying attention to, and it has to do with how much information we're going to get about this budgeting process. Is it possible we're going to get even less?
I just want to point out that when you have to write about zero-based budgeting versus current services, if you push a little button on the Mirror website and two little pills of no-dos will pop out and you can take them before you have to read the article.
I was enthralled personally.
I mean, trying my best to really boil it down. Some people get upset because they say too many legislators automatically assume that we have to maintain our current programs even if inflation makes them cost more every year. Why don't we just stay with the current level of funding, or call it zero-based, and current programs, and don't increase the funding? Here's the problem. The bill that was passed sounds like that's what it's doing. The people who've always wanted to see the state, stop building and these inflationary increases love it. But the bill doesn't do that. The bill that was passed does not change what the governor or the legislature can propose. It doesn't restrict in any way what they can adopt. It doesn't even restrict the type of forecasts the legislative analysts can issue except for one day of the year. That's it. On November 15th, when they issue this major report, they're no longer supposed to say, well, here's how much our revenue system will raise, and we're going to subtract from that how much our programs would cost if we adjust for inflation. They don't do that anymore. And by the way, that coincidentally was the same report that basically produced 4 years of embarrassment for the governor before in his first term, because it was sort of the canary in the coal mine warning of our impending deficits. All it does is eliminate that. So, I mean, you have so many people. I tried to think of an analogy that I could use. And if you had a law that says we're going to replace all soda in the school with juice, if you look at what the law actually does, it just puts a fresh juice sticker on cans of soda. It doesn't actually change the contents of what's in the can.
Colin?
So, you know, to me, it is one report that comes out every year. And the reality, I think, is that the legislators don't ultimately rely exclusively on that report.
Most don't read it.
Yeah, they don't read it. That, you know, and really everything kind of is in play. Everything is kind of on the table. So to me, it's another example of Governor Malloy not understanding how something's going to play at the level of public relations. He's going to get a lot more negative press about this than any value he's going to reap. I mean, and certainly the Republicans are having a field day with this. Themis Claridis is saying, how would less information help this process? And that's a fair question. I mean, I ultimately think there's probably less to this story than meets the eye. I don't think it represents any particular improvement from Malloy's end. I don't think it really necessarily creates that much more of a smokescreen or obfuscation than already exists. But the one thing it does is give Malloy another black eye at a time when he's got like 10 of them.
Daniela, any thoughts?
On his black eyes? yeah, I mean, I think in some ways a little bit of a tough couple of days. You know, Sue Hague of the Associated Press had a great story about the governor's relationships or lack thereof with members of the General Assembly. These are Democrats, people of his own party. You would think there would be a kinship there. According to her reporting, there really does not appear to be a very strong kinship. And that's you know, it just shows the level that we're at right now.
Yeah. Well, the one thing it might do is down the road, if there is another significant tax increase, you might have seen a few people in November give you an early warning saying, oh, OK, if you have a deficit that large, traditionally that's meant a tax increase. Well, if you don't get the deficit report, the tax increase may seem like it comes out of left field. So just sort of file away if you see one and you say, wow, I didn't see that coming. This might be why.
I just have to say something that didn't exactly come out of left field, but we were reading this week, in the midst of all this, as the state is broke and as the state is trying to find money anywhere it can and making these very dire budget projections, maybe having to have people cut their school budgets, et cetera, because not as much money is coming from the state. We read that the State Bond Commission, this is from the Connecticut Mirror, is expected to approve $22 million in financing to help a major hedge fund expand operations in Westport, Weldon, and Norwalk. Sparked criticism Tuesday from House Minority Leader Themis Claridis, who called the grant to a Stanford-based Bridgewater Associates dubious, given the state's fiscal woes. We're giving money to Bridgewater once again, Daniela, it seems like that is something we've been talking about for, lo, these past 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, and it's finally, I think, going to happen on Friday. It's a lot less money, as they point out, than was originally planned when they were going to build a new headquarters in Stanford, and that fell through. You know, Catherine Smith made the argument when I talked to her the other day that, you know, this is an investment. People go nuts when GE leaves. These are GE-caliber jobs. These are very high-paid jobs, and, you know, this is a good investment in the state. It's using bond money, not operations money, so you can't really mix and match the two. It's apples and oranges. This isn't the money that's being cut from school budgets and everything else. This is a separate pot of money. However, the optics don't look good, right? I mean, this is the biggest hedge fund in the world. And, you know, the state, which is, you know, struggling financially, is giving them money. It just does not look good.
Well, optics aside, is it a separate pot of money, Keith?
No. Unfortunately, it's not really. I think Danielle is right. The Malloy administration is in a no-win situation. If Bridgewater Associates were to leave, the Republicans would be going, oh, my God, here's another, you know, I mean, huge player that's gone. On the other hand, we are, because our revenues are so bad, we're literally stripping $1 billion in financing off the state's credit card. The bill that still has to be passed in special session, it passed in one chamber, not the other. cancels close to $1 billion in school construction, projects at higher ed institutions, projects in legislators' home districts. So at the same time we're giving Bridgewater $22 million on the credit card, everybody else is going home to their district saying, you know, that soccer field I thought I was going to get the financing for, those streetlights, that's not happening. It's still all relative.
Yeah, more money for Bridgewater, less money exposed for Bridgeport, Colin.
Yeah, I think this is – the problem is I don't think the Malloy administration can veer off from the philosophy that it launched into during its first term, and that is a philosophy of picking winners and losers. I mean, there's sort of two ways to go at this. Either you build a state that a lot of people might want to do business in because of the general business climate, because of the tax structure, because of infrastructure, education, cultural opportunities, all the things that make GE, for example, move to Boston. You know, you either do that or you hunt and peck. And they've gone with hunting and pecking, right? They pick winners and losers. They have their first five, and they do stuff like this. And I think it's ultimately a losing strategy, but I also don't think that Malloy could very easily veer off from it at this point. Probably it'll fall to the next governor to make a decision about whether that's how we go forward.
But to be fair, I mean, don't all states pick winners and losers? I mean, what did Massachusetts give to GE? You know, it wasn't just Boston's a dynamic world-class city. It was also, you know, we'll give you your heliport or airport or whatever they threw in there. I mean, you know, I think it's a little we can't just say, you know, they're the only ones doing this. It doesn't exist in a vacuum. And a lot of those bond projects were things that, you know, as you reported as well, Keith, you know, they're old things that have, you know, been sitting in the books for years. I mean, I called a couple of these folks, you know, the Northfield fire district, volunteer fire district, they had money in there that was stripped out. Well, it was going to finish up the upstairs of the firehouse, but, you know, we're just going to pass the boot and raise money and do it on our own. This is an old thing. We've got the firehouse. It's up and running. You know, we'd love to have this, but, you know, we realize we're not going to get it.
There's a little on both sides, though. The bonding was all low-hanging fruit. Gamble Pavilion's roof is pretty big fruit. That got put on hold. I think Colin, though, is spot on in that. I mean, yes, Danielle's right. There are winners and losers in every state. Connecticut is a pickier state. Can I make up a term? We really pick winners and losers. And it's once you're in that strategy, it's so hard to extricate yourself because we don't really have the resources to invest in the business climate now.
I want to quickly get to Joe in Hartford. Hi, Joe.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. Listen, I was hoping the panel could give me their thoughts on something. I'm not an economist by any means, but I did take a look at our the general fund and the state budget over the last 25, 30 years. And the thing that really struck me the most was that corporations 20, 25 years ago were contributing about 19% towards the general fund revenues. Today, that's less than 9%. And to expand on that, what you guys are talking about, the GE move. And, you know, in large part, I think they moved because Massachusetts offered them $150 million in tax incentives or subsidies. Why does a corporation that makes $160 billion need $150 million in tax subsidies? The point is, doesn't that affect our budget, our most vulnerable citizens, our education, healthcare, and infrastructure?
Well, hey, Joe, and I think you're asking exactly the relevant question. So, Keith, there is, I guess, the rub, and we've been through this over the weeks and the months and the years on this program, and Joe's bringing it back up again. Here's this question. I mean, we could give $150 million in tax credits. We could see companies like this leave. Certainly, if Bridgewater leaves or GE leaves, well, we'll have a lot less corporate money coming in. It might be a little less volatile in terms of the money that's coming in. What are you seeing what Joe's saying?
I would agree with most of what he said, especially about it's just not as profitable for corporations. The one thing I would caution him, though, you can't just look at the state's corporation tax. Large numbers of corporations pay through the income tax. We've shifted so many burdens. People underestimate how much in property taxes corporations pay. There's a lot more to the tax burden than just the corp tax.
We're talking with Keith Vanoff of the Connecticut Mirror, Daniela Altomare of the Hartford Current, our own Colin McEnroe from the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about Dan Malloy on the national stage, how he's getting along with Democrats, whether or not Democrats are actually going to be in the majority in the legislature after this election day. We'll take some of your phone calls at 860-275-7266. It's The Wheelhouse here on WNPR. This is The Wheelhouse here on WNPR, our weekly news roundtable. You can join Lucy Nalpathanchil for Where We Live coming up tomorrow. Colin McEnroe and I are here. Colin McEnroe is the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hey, what's on your show today, Colin?
Buzz Aldrin. Do I need to say anything more?
What? Buzz Aldrin's on your show today?
Buzz Aldrin's on our show today, yes. And that's all I need to say, really.
That's
Buzz
so Aldrin. Cool. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. So Buzz Aldrin is going to be on The Colin McEnroe Show today. So you should listen to that at 1 o'clock. You should also read Daniela Altomare, who writes about what's happening at the State House for the Hartford Current, and Keith Faniff, who writes about what's happening with the state budget for the Connecticut Mirror. They join us in The Wheelhouse as well. We'll take some more of your phone calls at 860-275-7266. You can comment on our website, WNPR.org, or find us on our new Facebook and Twitter feeds at WNPR Wheelhouse. Now, one thing we talk about and think about a lot is the role of Governor Dan Malloy here in Connecticut and in the rest of the nation. He's the chair of the Democratic Governors Association. He sat next to First Lady Michelle Obama at the State of the Union address and will have a major role at the Democratic National Convention as co-chair of the platform committee. He's also extremely unpopular among Connecticut voters right now. Last week, an article in The Atlantic asked, how long does it take to ruin a perfectly good progressive reputation? It's actually something, Colin, we've talked about a little bit here on the program over the years. There's this really weird thing where the national media has called, at times, Governor Malloy the most liberal governor in America, and then we see very different things here. I mean, what can we make of Governor Malloy's national reputation versus what is happening at the state level where he does seem to be increasingly unpopular, even amongst Democrats?
He never struck me as a progressive, and I think maybe he seems like a progressive from the outside for a couple of different reasons. One of them is that there just aren't that many Democratic governors. The last time I checked, I think there were about 18 out of 50. So there aren't that many people to compare him to. And you know, on certain issues, if you look at stuff like the decriminalization of marijuana, if you look at the things that constitute in multiple years, his so-called Second Chance Initiative, his attempt to reform the justice system. You know, if you look at his opposition to the death penalty, if you look at his stance on guns, yeah, probably does kind of fit into the progressive framework somewhere. But I've always thought that he was closer to a Hillary Clinton Democrat than to a Bernie Sanders Democrat. But yeah, here locally, it's his problems, we could spend all day. We could spend the whole show just trying to explain what his problems have been. Some of them just go back to something that Daniela alluded to in the first segment, which is he's kind of not good with people. I mean, one of the easiest things in the world for him to do would be to be more collegial with Democratic legislators, or even Republican legislators. I mean, John Roland was extraordinarily good at making friends with people from the other party, so many friends that they were really not willing to impeach him when it came time. They had to be dragged kicking and screaming into launching a House Select Committee against their old buddy, John Roland, despite the fact that he was Republican and they were a Democrat. I mean, it's things like that. He could do a lot of things to help himself. That's not that hard. You know, get the legislative leadership in there, make them feel like they're in a non-adversarial position. We're all in this boat together. And that is just not who he is.
Yeah, it's interesting. I read a line about Andrew Cuomo, and it seems to fit with Governor Malloy as well. It says he's progressive on issues that don't cost money. Something to that effect. I mean, when you look at, you know, things like, gay rights and, you know, he's really at the forefront of a lot of these things. Yet on the minimum wage, he kind of had to be kicking and be dragged in kicking and screaming. In the end, he was a big proponent of it. But, you know, initially he was very wary. You know, so a lot of these sort of pocketbook issues, tax and spend issues, he's definitely more of a centrist than his image would appear.
Keith?
I always go back to – I think Daniela nailed it. I go back to his very first State of the State address in 2011 and watching the Democratic faces when the governor talking about the income tax said, I don't believe in punishing success. I mean that's a line that Reagan Republicans would use to defend a flat tax. There are still plenty of people in labor who remember that line.
It turns out success believes in punishing us. But who knew?
Well, in his battles with the teachers, you know, the teachers unions, I mean, you know, he has a history there of you know, some sort of difficult relationships with some of these labor folks.
Now, as Colin mentioned before, one of the governor's top priorities right now is passing a bill that might boost his liberal cred. It's the Second Chance Society legislation, strengthening of this. Now, here's Republican Rep. Jason Perillo in a video to his constituents.
The governor is hell-bent on passing what he calls his Second Chance program. What that does, it allows 20 and 21-year-olds to avoid the penalties for the felonies they commit. Now, these 20 and 21-year-olds, they can vote, they can go to war for us. In fact, they can even serve on juries. but the governor does not want them held accountable for the crimes they've committed.
So, Daniela, first of all, a lot in here. We've been talking about the Second Chance Society initiatives for quite some time. The governor has gotten some reforms passed. He certainly has gotten a lot of national press for this. Republicans, as already stated, have been pushing back right now. I guess I'll ask first, is what we're hearing from Jason Perillo right in his analysis of Governor Malloy's Second Chance proposal right now?
Well, first of all, this whole issue of criminal justice reform, it really isn't a liberal conservative thing anyway. I mean, nationally, a lot of very conservative groups have sort of embraced it, and Republican governors have embraced it. So it doesn't fit in neatly into this mold, because there's big cost savings, obviously, if you do things differently regarding criminal justice. But, you know, here in Connecticut, some Republicans and some Democrats as well are very wary of one piece of this proposal. It's a two-headed thing. There's one piece that deals with reforming the bail system, and that seems to have a lot of support. Even among Republicans, the Yankee Institute is a huge proponent of this. You know, these people aren't necessarily bedfellows with Malloy on a lot of issues. They love this. The second piece is, as Representative Perillo was talking about, deals with juvenile justice and how we treat younger offenders. And that seems to be a little more problematic for a lot of Republicans and Democrats. And that's the kind of thing that, you know, you can just envision, as my colleague Chris Keating had a story about this in today's paper, you know, you can envision the mailers, you know, Representative Smith is soft on crime. He wants to let a, you know, 19-year-old killer out in the loose to terrorize again. I mean, it's a pretty powerful political weapon.
Keith?
Yeah, this is the latest installment of Everything Goes Back to the Budget. If you remember last year, I mean, the Democrats in the legislature really got beaten up when they replaced all these promised tax cuts with tax increases, then GE leaves. They came into this session so wary. A lot of people were predicting nothing of substance would pass. Anything that's as risky as Daniela describes is going to have a tough time getting votes. And when you've got no Republican votes contributed, I think people are going to be very wary. If they pass anything, it would probably just be the bail reforms.
Everything Goes Back to the Budget. Actually, the name of the first track off of Keith's band's new record. Your band is, of course, called The Implementers. It's a post-punk band.
It's my spoken language album. Yes, These Things I Believe.
Colin?
Okay, well, yeah, let's just sort of look at some of the specifics here. First of all, in terms of bail reform, that should be a gimme, right? Our bail system in this country is a joke. It does exactly the opposite of what it's supposed to do. Our bail system is supposed to allow people who have not been tried, who are awaiting trial, who have not been convicted of anything, to not be held in detention for long periods of time. We know nationally people are held for 6 years at a time, 6 years at a stretch without having a trial because they can't make bail. So obviously, yes, we need bail reform. This one, which applies to misdemeanors, seems like a pretty easy thing to do. Now, on the juvenile front, I can tell you one of the places that Dan Malloy got this idea. Germany. Remember when we went over to Germany?
Yeah.
We studied looking at their prison systems. Well, this is one thing that they do. And one of the things that they figured out is that, A, the longer you can keep a young offender out of the adult prison system, and their prisons are not the corrupting hellholes that our prisons are, but still, if you can keep them out of the adult prison system, you can find something else to do with them. I think they stretch it in some cases as high as maybe 26 years old. I mean, they have incredibly high limits and the whole idea is, yeah, it's cheaper to do that. It's better. They're less likely to reoffend, to become career criminals, to be hardened off. It makes a lot of sense. Perillo's video, I think, is a little disingenuous. Judges under this system still, with a violent or dangerous offender, they have the discretion to put that person right back into the criminal justice system. So, I mean, with somebody who raped somebody at gunpoint or something like that, I don't think you're going to see them tried as a juvenile offender. Although in Europe, they would say, no, let's try to do that. Let's try to keep that person out. I have one more thing to say about this budget-wise. The thing that concerns me is, as you take these young offenders, these offenders 21 and below, and try to reclassify them as juvenile offenders, you've got to be able to deliver services to them. You've got to deliver vocational services. You've got to deliver the kinds of services that will keep them from being reoffenders. There's no point in doing this if you don't have a system that can help these people stay in society as productive citizens. That's exactly the kind of thing that we're cutting right now. I mean, we're cutting everything, obviously, but CJTS, which is the notorious youth prison that was built under the Roland administration, administration has over the years tried to repurpose itself as a real place that can deliver services, vocational training. They had a lot of people there who were laid off without notice, without even caseworkers who didn't have a chance to say goodbye to these young people who had learned to trust them. There's plans, I think, to shut CJTS in 2018. You'd have, if you do that, they'd all be in Manson. Only Connecticut would have a youth prison named Manson. But anyway, you'd have Manson, which is not in a position to deliver these kinds of services. I mean, don't do second chance if you're not prepared to do something with these young offenders. If you don't have that support system, then it's an empty gesture.
Well, and Keith, that's, I think, the thing that those of us from the outside who aren't in the building every day, like you and Daniela and these lawmakers in the governor's office are, that's what we're kind of looking for, is some sense that these two sides are working together hand in hand, that indeed if we think that we can save money and have better outcomes for society with something called the Second Chance Initiative, and that it has bipartisan support in the broad strokes, if not in some of the weeds, it's something that we can do, but we can only do in conjunction with the services that back it up, and we're slashing at those services. I mean, is there anybody down there having that conversation about how we keep those services intact and also make these changes to the laws?
Yeah, that's – I couldn't lay it out better than Colin did. That's the only thing I think we could add to it, is that the people who are not necessarily leery because of the political repercussions, the potential repercussions that Daniela talked about. There are those who are wary that this dynamic that Colin talked about would only exist on paper, that if you don't fund enough anti-recidivism programs, then you're just dangling this dream, but you're not actually implementing it. Because I think Colin's right. There's tons of evidence that it works. But don't forget, we've had layoffs in the Department of Labor going back a year now. I mean, there's some concerns. What do you do if somebody gets out of prison in Willimantic? And to find a job, they have to, I don't know, hitch down Route 32 to Norwich to a Labor Department office down there to actually get some assistance. You've got to have at least some infrastructure of services.
Well, okay. Well, since you mentioned political repercussions, we've become accustomed to Democrats here in the state having control of both legislative chambers at the Capitol. Governing Magazine now thinks the state Senate is up for grabs in November. Daniela, they're calling it a toss-up. I mean, is there a sense that out of all of this, that bad budgets, the idea that the governor is not wildly popular, that maybe the legislature is even less so, or at least on par with the governor's unpopularity, that maybe there's a sea change happening, that there may be a change at least in one of the two houses of the legislature?
Maybe. I mean, I don't know if it's like Congress where, you know, I hate them all except for my, you know, my congressperson. There could be some of that going on. I don't know. But certainly, you know, the Republicans have already basically laid it out. They're running against Governor Malloy. That is clear. They have, you know, if you went to their convention the other day, they mentioned Malloy, I think maybe more than Trump. I mean, you know, they talked about him constantly, and they will run against him, and they will use his unpopularity to kind of hurt, you know, Democrats in the legislature. There's certainly pockets of the state where they, you know, would see. I mean, Eastern Connecticut, they've picked up a bunch of seats there in recent years. New London County, you know, who knows? I mean, if they put up good candidates, presumably they could make some inroads.
So statistically, people vote straight ticket more in over the last couple of decades. They used to split their tickets. They used to vote straight ticket. Then they started to split their tickets. Now they're voting straight tickets more. But this is a pretty complicated. But Connecticut people like to split their tickets. This is kind of a complicated thing, though, these races. So the first thing I wanted to say is ballot position. So you're looking at really a fourth or fifth ballot position a lot of these races. So Trump versus Clinton could be pretty important this time. Mm-hmm. If people are really locked in, if they're focused on that, then the next thing they'll see or the Senate and Congress races, then they'll look at the legislative races. Are they going to split their tickets at that point? A lot of people still will. And you could – I mean, these other my two friends here, they know so much more about the legislature than I do. I could name a couple of Senate seats that are very tippy right now that have been in Democratic control. You can start with Andy Maynard's, which is up for grabs, and Heather Summers, who's actually had some statewide exposure, is running for it. I mean, there are some seats that are very tippy. And if they run a smart – overall state Senate campaign, if they coordinate it well and coordinate that message, and they probably are, as has been suggested, going to kind of Willie Horton this whole second chance thing a little bit. If they if their rhetoric resonates well with people, if they target other areas, I would say probably I keep talking about this spine. It's Route 8 or the Naugatuck River. Take your pick. That's the area where Trump ran incredibly strong, 70% town by town by town in the Republican primaries. They may have some real strongholds there. So, yeah, I mean, maybe they could flip the Senate.
Keith?
Yeah, I think if you look at the issues they're targeting right now, it goes back to what Daniela said. They're all issues that basically call up Governor Malloy. They're attacking people about hospital cutbacks. Social service. We have Republicans campaigning against social service cutbacks. And, of course, everybody's pointing to GE. All of these issues, really the focus is much more on Governor Malloy than on the Democrats in the legislature.
So while we were away, Speaker of the House Brendan Sharkey, he is a Democrat, announced that he is retiring after two terms as Speaker.
My tenure as Speaker has been marked by quite a lot of very difficult decisions and challenges for the state of Connecticut. It began with the Newtown tragedy and our response to that, and then continued through a number of other trials and tribulations leading up to ultimately the budget that we just passed last week. And throughout, it's been a challenge.
And it sounds like it's been a challenge. I mean, what should we read, Daniela, of Brendan Sharkey deciding, I'm going to get out of this right now? I mean, this has been bad, bad, bad. I don't want to have to deal with this stuff anymore. I'm out.
Yeah, I don't know. I these decisions are always complicated and there are personal issues and everything else. So, you know, who really knows what sort of tipped the balance? But clearly it's a grind. It's draining. It's difficult. It's, you know, nobody likes you. There are no good choices. I mean, it can't be fun.
And it sets up House Majority Leader Joe Arisimowitz to become the next speaker. His role in the long, drawn-out budget process has angered some union leaders, and Arisimowitz is a union official himself, Colin. Can we talk about this for a moment?
Yeah, I mean, I just don't think this should happen. I feel like Connecticut doesn't understand the meaning of conflict of interest. When I used to tell people that the minority leader of the House of Representatives was a partner in one of the biggest lobbying firms that was active in the General Assembly, I don't know, three, four, Brown Rufkin. It's got to be one of the three or four most active.
And this was Larry Caffaro.
This was Larry Caffaro. Very nice guy. Not lobbying actively on behalf of Brown Rufkin, on behalf of their clients, but still a partner in that firm. When I tell people from outside the state, they go, what are you talking about? That can't be right. Well, it was. And I feel the same way about Arisimowitz. I mean, his job, his company, so to speak, his union, is materially affected by virtually, you know, well, all the financial decisions, all the stuff that Keith covers. I don't know how I just don't know how that person can be Speaker of the House. It just seems to me that that's inherently a conflict. I thought that Larry Caffaro would have had to recuse himself from like 40% of the bills that the legislature considered if we took the notion of conflict of interest seriously. That number would probably be higher for Arisimowitz, but we just don't even have that rule. Connecticut just doesn't think that way.
And if one of the biggest things we're talking about in the future of the budget here, Keith, is what the state is going to do in coming to terms with its union contracts and dealing with state union workers, I mean, how much bigger an issue is that?
I think that's going to be huge because when you boil away all the politics, the one thing you can't change is that our debt costs are going to eat up hundreds of millions of extra dollars year after year after year, and it's not going to change for probably two decades. You got part of the caucus that wants to go on the austerity bandwagon and another that said it's too hard. We've got to raise more revenue. If you have to assemble a budget and twist arms and you have these two totally opposite directions, that's going to break just about any leader. It's going to be really hard for Joe Arisimowitz to build coalitions.
We're talking with Keith Faniff, state budget reporter for the Connecticut Mirror, our own Colin McEnroe from the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, and Daniela Altomare from the Hartford Current. When we come back, we're going to find out what happens when a party books its speaker way too far in advance for its big party event. We're also going to find out a little bit of what I learned about American politics while I was overseas in the UK. And they're finally playing baseball in Hartford, just not the kind of baseball we wanted. That's next in the Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Conversations about reforming our criminal justice system focus on how policies impact the people behind bars, but what about the impact on their families? Tomorrow on Where We Live with Lucy Nalpathanchil, we'll hear about new research and the challenges children face when their parents are incarcerated. That's coming up tomorrow. Hope you can join us. Today in our weekly news roundtable, I'm joined by Colin McEnroe from The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, Keith Vanna from the Connecticut Mirror, and Daniela Altamari from the Hartford Current. Join our conversation on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. Remember Carly Fiorina? Yeah, she used to be running for president, and then she was running for vice president with Ted Cruz. That didn't last too long. Turns out, though, that the state GOP booked her well in advance as the key speaker for the Prescott Bush Awards dinner. That happened last night. She didn't talk much about frontrunner Donald Trump, who she hasn't exactly seen eye to eye with. She did, however, talk about Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton.
It will be up to the nominee of our party and to all of us as Republicans to remind people of the level of corruption in service of ambition that this woman represents.
Again, that's Carly Fiorina last night. Daniela, your colleague Chris Keating from The Current was there. He reported turnout for the Prescott Bush dinner was down a little bit, about 500 people in attendance. One of those kind of, well, you shrug your shoulders kind of events. What are you going to do when you've booked somebody who's not running for president anymore and is probably at odds with the presidential frontrunner?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough. I remember the year they had Ann Romney in, and it was right, you know, when her husband was running, and it was sort of her moment, her big coming out, and it was, you know, huge buzz. You know, it's tough, these speeches. I mean, you know, I don't know. You know, even the party faithful, I don't know how connected they are to any of these speakers.
And I guess I'm wondering, Colin, how connected we feel the party faithful here in Connecticut is to Donald Trump. I mean, you have, you know, Carly Fiorina speaking to this group last night. They're trying hard to rally around Donald Trump as their presidential nominee. I'm sure that across the board, that's not exactly a popular choice.
Yeah, so this is an incredibly awkward and uncomfortable moment. So, as you say, Carly was booked as a speaker before she became Ted Cruz's running mate, and certainly before Donald Trump became not only the presumptive nominee, but the across-the-board winner of the Connecticut delegates. And the whole thing, and she last night, she kind of Voldemorted Trump, you know? She kept talking about our party's nominee like she didn't know his name, or you just couldn't say his name out loud or something like that. It was a very odd thing. And so part of the problem is, look, there's some people who kind of have to get on board, you know, members of the Republican National Committee, pretty much they kind of have to get on board. There's some people who want to get on board because they want to be players. You can't be a player in the Republican world here in Connecticut heading into the 2016 election if you're not on board with Trump. What are you going to do? You're going to be an outlier. There are other people who sort of see Trump as something that they may be able to exploit. One of the reasons that Themis Claridis, having denounced Trump, you know, pretty outwardly in 2015, was one of the first to jump over the line back towards Trump, is she sees a chance to pick up seats on her side in the House if they can run an effective campaign. She's also got her eyes probably on the 2018 gubernatorial nomination. So she wants to be a player. You can't be a player right now if you're not with Trump. The people who stayed home are the people who don't care about any of that stuff. They would include people who often cough up some money for stuff, and they maybe not interested in coughing up money, paying a high ticket price to go see Carly and to go support Trump. I mean, there's some people who are just saying, no, thanks.
Keith, quickly.
It was kind of embarrassing that, like, right after this speaker's locked up, boom, Ted Cruz makes his decision. But I think there are some Republicans who are really hoping that Trump will boost turnout and still make a difference, a positive difference for the Republicans in Connecticut.
Now, I was just in the UK last week. I was at the BBC in London, and then I was up in Scotland for a couple of days. And I actually got a strange window into American politics. First of all, I don't think it's a great surprise that people around the world, Colin, pay much closer attention to American politics than we pay to their politics. I was inundated with people asking questions about Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, and most specifically about Donald Trump. You know, I talked to a kind of a stereotypical London black cab driver who was excited about Trump's rise. He said that his country's going down the tubes. The UK is citing what he called a wave of immigrants from who knows where flooding his country. He says Trump has got that part right. and wished British politicians would take a similar stand. Meanwhile, my wife rode in an Uber with an East African guy in a flashy Lexus who thought the idea of Trump was embarrassing for America. We heard from a lot of other people who said the same thing. In Scotland, where they say that their politics start at Bernie Sanders and then go to the left, the whole system seemed like a puzzle to them. Why don't we have more choice than just these two people? But it was just so interesting. Over and over and over again, people in the streets and cafes, colleagues at the BBC, they all just wanted to know about Donald Trump and what the hell's going on in America.
Well, he's also injected himself into the conversation a little bit, right? I mean, he has said stuff that British politicians, including David Cameron, have felt the need to react negatively against. He's been embraced a little bit by Nigel Farage, who is the most prominent politician identified with the so-called Brexit, the departure of Great Britain, the notional departure of Great Britain from the European Union. I will say that Britain's there's a nativist Trump-like wave that's swept independently across Europe. It's never been as bad as Britain. Even the Nigel Farage people, the United Kingdom Independence Party or whatever they're called, they're not that comfortable with Marine Le Pen in France. So much so that they actually sought to kind of keep her out of England. They can't seem to make any kind of common cause with her in the European Parliament. Meanwhile, in Britain, there were 500,000 signatures demanding that Trump not be allowed in the country because of his so-called hate speech. I think the British Parliament actually debated that. So what you see elsewhere, whether it's with Geert Wilders in the Netherlands or Matteo Salvini in Italy, or certainly Marine Le Pen in France, it's not quite the same in Britain. There's something going on with the Brexit, but it's not at that level.
You know, what was interesting is in Glasgow, one of the guys I talked to said, you know, he felt like Trump was just an entertainer. He was going to be an embarrassment to America. But at the same time, he felt like he was getting something right about this immigration crisis. You know, there really is a problem in the UK. People, once again, saying coming from all over, we need to shut down the borders. He also then went on to say that he was very proud of the fact that Glasgow is the curry capital of Europe. And I was wondering aloud to him where all those folks came from who make the delicious curry that he eats.
Yeah. And I mean, look, it's these are issues that in some ways Europe began struggling with sooner than we did. You could have had a conversation with a Paris cab driver any time in the last, I would say, 8 years that would make Trump sound like some kind of moderate on immigration. All of these tensions have been heightened for a whole bunch of different reasons, just including acclimating to the notion of a European Union, the open borders, the greater proximity to certain areas from which immigrants come. There's a whole bunch of things that feed into this. But, you know, Britain, I don't know, it's kept its head a little bit above those waters.
I want to end with a story probably that they wouldn't care about at all in Great Britain, because they watch cricket over there. I spent some time trying to watch cricket, and I still don't understand the game at all. I do, however, understand the game of baseball. While I was away last week, I was excited to come back and watch baseball in Hartford. You know, it's supposed to be starting at this new minor league ballpark, Dunkin' Donuts Park. Colin, are we going to see games when they're supposed to be played or not?
I think that's anybody's guess at this point. Certainly the latest indication is that even if they were to get onto the timetable that they say that they're kind of on right now, the Yard Goats would need what they call a burn-in period of about 2 weeks to, you know, figure out how the scoreboard works and train their people to run the hot dog machines or whatever. I mean, you can't just sort of move in the next day to a stadium and expect your entire staff to know how everything works. So now we're talking, you know, third week of June at the best. And if things go worse, or if Hartford were to decide to call the bond, which I don't think they're going to do, then the whole thing can tumble into court and you don't play any games there this year.
And, of course, Hartford is a city that's struggling with its own problems. Luke Bronin and the budget and everything else. What's going to happen there? Were you at all amused, Keith, by the fact that there has actually been baseball played at Dunkin' Donuts Park? It's just by a group of, like, dopey kids who broke in?
I'm sorry. I'm just a baseball addict, so I love that. I feel like if I could have somehow broken in to watch it, I'd have been tempted to.
Danielle, I mean, what are you seeing as you're seeing this baseball stadium that's never going to get built, it seems, but at least you've got some kids, you know, going in and playing while the, you know, like construction equipment's still there.
Yeah, it's pretty wild.
Although one of the kids seems to be an employee of the contractor.
Yeah.
So
yes,
which makes it an even more uncomfortable situation. It's like the Yard Goats can't play there because you're not building it fast enough, but you can get drunk and go play there.
That should be a tagline. You can get drunk and go play there. It'll be interesting to see. Maybe by the next Wheelhouse or the next Wheelhouse after that, we'll finally be able to talk about a little bit of baseball in downtown Hartford. Colin McEnroe is the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. He has got Buzz Aldrin on the show this afternoon.
I know. I can't believe it myself.
That's very, very cool. So join Colin this afternoon at 1 o'clock. Thanks so much. Also, thanks to Keith Van of State Budget Reporter for the Connecticut Mirror and a big baseball fan. Thank you, Keith.
Thank you.
Thank you to Daniela Altamari, State House Reporter for the Hartford Current. Thank you, Daniela.
Thanks.
Our program today produced by Tucker Ives with help from Lydia Brown. Kion Wolf, our technical producer, is off today. Heather Brandon is our digital editor. The executive producer of The Wheelhouse is Katie Talarski. Continue this conversation, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. I'll be back next week. Lucy Nalpathanchil is here with Where We Live tomorrow. Hope you can join us.